Please call the case.
Case number SCWC 13-86, State versus Abden. Arguing for the petitioner is Phyllis J. Hironaka, Deputy Public Defender. Arguing for the respondent is Stephen K. Tsushima, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney. Argument on the merits.
Well, good morning, Ms. Hironaka, Mr. Tsushima. You're both ready to proceed? All right, and we'll give you a warning with 5 minutes to go. You've reserved 5 minutes for your rebuttal, Ms. Hironaka, and 5 minute warning for you as well, Mr. Tsushima. Please proceed. Thank you.
May it please the court, Deputy Public Defender Phyllis Hironaka appearing on behalf of Junjun Mas Abdon. Mr. Abdon respectfully requests that this honorable court reverse the ICA's decision with respect to the presentation of evidence and proof that the state has complied with the requirements of the timeliness beyond a reasonable doubt as reflected in Section 2A of the majority's opinion and Section 1 of the concurring opinion. Mr. Abdon specifically requests that this court underscore that H.R. 701114 means what it says. Number one, that no person may be convicted without proof beyond a reasonable doubt of the factors listed in there. And number two, that in the absence of the proof required by all the things listed in number one, that the innocence of the defendant is presumed. And third, to clarify that if the state is relying on a tolling provision in the time limitations, that it must first, allege the facts in the indictment or complaint, and second, prove those facts to the trier or the jury beyond a reasonable doubt.
Well, Ms. Hironaka, since you focused on this point as to the failure to sufficiently allege timeliness in the jury instructions, wouldn't it, assuming your position to be correct, wouldn't it nonetheless mean that this was error, that when considered in terms of harmlessness would be considered to be harmless error?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. And the reason why is because 114 has those list of factors that say this is what the state is required to prove. So if we're going to let the state have a pass, so to speak, then they're having a pass on things that they must prove beyond a reasonable doubt. So 114 lists in 1E facts establishing that the offense was committed within the time period specified in Section 701108.
But doesn't the evidence, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but doesn't the evidence show that? Doesn't the evidence?
The evidence did not show that to the trier of fact, and the trier of fact did not find so in this case. They were not instructed so in this case.
Is there any dispute as to when it was that the offense was committed and what the age was of the victim in this case?
There is not a dispute as to those items, no. But as to the proof, they were not proven.
Help me with that.
Yeah, I'm not sure I understood that.
Yeah, if you could help me with that idea. Why weren't they proven then?
701-108. Is the time limitations, which is referenced in 701114E. It says under subsection 2 that a prosecution for a Class A felony, which this was, must be commenced within 6 years after it is committed. If we drop down to subsection 6, it says that the period of limitation does not run under subsection C for any felony offense under Chapter 707, Part 5, which is where this was, during any time where the victim is alive and under 18 years of age.
So is it your argument that you have to show that there has to be a finding by the jury that there was a felony offense? I mean, that's what that section you just read said. Or how about that it says Chapter 707? Do we need to submit that to the jury? Or that it's part of Part 5 or Part 6?
I think that the jury instructions don't mean to be that specific, and in response to, I believe it was the state.
But under your argument, if we take your argument, which the statute says facts establishing that the offense was committed within the time period, it doesn't reference about producing the date of the indictment, nor does it say anything about, in that subsection, about showing that it's part of Chapter 707 or Part 5 or 6.
I would say respectfully that I believe that the parties can stipulate to some of these things. As many times in the settling of jury instruction, for example, if, like with a paraphernalia statute, when they list all those different things that constitute paraphernalia, the parties just agree that it's just that one, you know, pipe or whatever the case may be, so that the jury is focused. I'm thinking that with respect to, instruction could be proffered to the effect of under 701-108-6C, which was listed in the indictment, this prosecution can be found to be timely commenced if this indictment has been filed on or before 6 years after M.A., the complaining witness, ceases to be under 18 years of age.
So it's your argument that the indictment, how do you prove the date of indictment under your analysis?
Okay, there would be several ways. Of course, the state can submit the indictment into evidence.
Okay, so the indictment, that's what I'm wondering about. So the indictment will go into evidence.
It can go into evidence.
Because the government, if the government has to prove something, mm-hmm. it's their ability to prove it the way they wish. So under your scenario, you can introduce this indictment into evidence, and this indictment says on it, the grand jury charges, and then it states the whole offense. It says that the person knowingly subjected to sexual penetration, the victim, it has the dates, it has the time, it's signed by the actual prosecutor who prosecuted this case, it's signed by the foreperson, all of that's okay under your scenario. And it says a true bill.
Okay. This is where I'm saying that the parties can agree to stipulate, or would most likely agree to stipulate, because it cuts both ways. I see what your point is with respect to there are many prejudicial things that are contained in an indictment that most of the times the jury does not hear. But
in fact, you folks asked for the general instructions, which says the indictment is a mere formal accusation and it's
correct.
Not evidence of defendant's guilt. Your argument today is that it is evidence of defendant's guilt and that they should look at the date of the indictment. So we're going to have to come up with a jury instruction that says we've introduced the jury indictment, the grand jury indictment, and members of the jury, you can consider it as evidence to prove the date, but you can't use it for anything else? Is that what the argument is?
Essentially, although it is very awkward in that regard. This whole thing is quite a thorny issue, and I can't say that there's clear lines to any particular answer. But with respect to Mr. Abdon's particular case, that was the problem.
What about Justice Chief Judge Nakamura's argument that this is a judicially noticeable or judicially known date?
Again, I have to respectfully disagree with Chief Judge Nakamura. Again, it's 701-114 clearly states that it has to be proven, and by taking judicial notice, it relieves the prosecution of its burden of proof, and it also, in the same respect, denies the defendant due process for having every item, every fact proven beyond a reasonable doubt.
But if a court takes judicial notice, then it's proof. And our law on judicial notice has specifically said the most common time judicial notice is utilized, this is from Steve versus Akana, the most frequent use of judicial notice of ascertainable facts is in noting the content of court records. This is part of the court records.
I draw the court's attention to Hoy Rules of Evidence 201, particularly G, which talks about instructing the jury. And it says in a civil proceeding, et cetera, but then it also says in a criminal proceeding or in a criminal case, the court shall instruct the jury, so there's a shall, that it may but is not required to accept as conclusive any fact which is judicially noticed. So even if the court were to take judicial notice of the date, the jury does not have to accept that fact.
So that means the indictment goes into evidence. Because nobody else can actually talk about the indictment because there'd be a best evidence issue.
There are things that cut both ways in this case.
Well, Ms. Hironaka, yes. You can concede that normally proving the date of the offense is just left to the evidence. It's not normally the case that a the prosecution's required to submit the indictment. So are you concerned about that normal practice of establishing, because 701.114 requires, you know, establishing the date of the offense, but that's normally just established by evidence presented during the trial.
Correct, Your Honor.
I mean, when you, I think your concern in this case is where you're talking about facts that pertain to tolling. This is a sort of a fact-driven type of analysis, and one that deserves the attention of an instruction on that specific issue. And perhaps that is the case, mm-hmm. that there should be such an instruction, but the lack of giving the instruction, I guess, has to be evaluated in terms of error as to whether it's harmless or not. And you're saying that almost ipso facto, almost automatically, it can't be a harmless error because it somehow relieves the government of the burden of proof. But I don't quite follow that, because that begs the question of the harmless error analysis. Has the government presented enough evidence to prove its case? And if so, it may be that an error committed is harmless. So that brings me back to this. It seems like almost a classic situation of if it's error, it's harmless, because it's pretty clear what the date of the victim was and pretty clear what the date of the offense is.
Well, if, for example, let me step back from that. With respect to whether it's harmless, I'm going to refer the court to the language. I mean, there are two cases, I believe it's Stans Contracting and Correa, which say that the components of 701-108 are baseline substantive components that the prosecution must prove beyond a reasonable doubt at trial, and that silence by the defendant on the issue of timeliness does not relieve the prosecution of its burden of proving that component. Rather, facts establishing timeliness, like facts establishing jurisdiction, must be averred in order to fulfill the due process requirements. And in this case, they were averred, but for the date of the indictment.
But didn't in both of those cases, I mean, Iuli ends, we therefore hold the trial court's failure to instruct the jury on these matters was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Correa says the same thing. On these facts, we conclude the lower court's failure to instruct the jury as to the timeliness of the prosecution and venue is error, that is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. Why isn't that the same disposition that should be reached in this case? Clearly, the government adduced the requisite facts.
Those cases did not involve a tolling provision of the statute of limitations, whereas this case does.
And what difference would that make?
Because normally this case on its face would be untimely, except that the state alleged facts that brought it within that exception to say that, yes, we are timely.
But under your rule, it would apply to every single case. I think that's what the ICA was, Chief Judge Nakamura was saying. You know, your rule would apply across the board, every single case. Government would have to show something was timely. With the date of the indictment.
Right. I mean, initially when I was working on this case, I was thinking that it should only go to the unusual situation where the state invokes the statute of limitations, some kind of a tolling provision. However, in thinking about it more deeply, I do think that it does go to the to all cases, because say 701.114 is plain language that says what it says. And in Correa, that was the one where they said that the state had claimed that the trial court was not required to instruct the jury on timeliness and venue, and the ICA disagreed on that one, saying that the trier still has to find the fact. Where timeliness and venue are issues, the jury has to be instructed.
Your argument is based on 701.114E. So Would we also, if, hasn't there been case law saying, however, with respect to C and D, jurisdiction and venue, that doesn't have to go to the jury or to the fact finder?
I'm not sure if there's case law that says that. I'm thinking about there's law that says that C and D, I believe it is, are of constitutional magnitude, and that's why they must be established beyond a reasonable doubt. There was a question.
I see. So jurisdiction, okay, venue within the city and county of Honolulu.
On every single case, in other words, I think what Justice McKenna, every single case starts out, and this was your instruction that you submitted, that on or about June 1st, 1997, to including June 30th, 1990, in the city and county of Honolulu, state of Hawaii. We have the date, we have the venue, we have the jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. We don't ask the jury to go look at the statute and figure out whether or not that gives the First Circuit jurisdiction. Similarly, when we ask them to find dates of when this incident occurred, on how old the person was, and her birthday, we don't have to ask the jury to go back find the date the indictment was returned.
I think the problem that I have is that in order for this indictment to be valid, since the time period was told, it was out of the normal statute of limitations of 6 years from the date of the offense, which would be 97 to whatever that was, that the state understands contracting had to allege it in the indictment, which they did.
Which they did. So but are we going to ask the jury to instruct them that this is a 3 year or 6 year and that they have to make a finding on, as to whether or not it's told, and give them the rules as to tolling too?
That seems to be what 114 requires by proof.
It depends how you read it.
Okay. What I was going to say is that the fact that the state had to allege those things in the indictment, and the jury heard evidence on her birth date, et cetera, and the fact that she was still alive, they were not told to do anything with that evidence. So in other words, there was something, they were presented evidence, but they weren't asked to make any conclusion based upon.
That's not entirely accurate. They had to find that she was less than 14 years old at the time of the offense. So they did have to do something. Maybe not exactly what on the tolling, but they had to find out, they had to know when she was born, when the incident occurred, and that she was less than 14 at the time of the offense.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. But otherwise, I mean, those words in the, or those requirements that are stated in there, they're not accusatory, but they would otherwise be surplusage. They wouldn't, it wouldn't make sense as to why they are there with respect to what the state has to prove.
Well, Ms. Hironaka, maybe you could address the argument that is focused on the Timoteo case that says that there is a waiver of the challenge to the statute of limitations because of a failure to raise the issue until after the verdict.
Justice, I have a problem with the conclusion of the ICA, both majority and concurring opinion, that Mr. Abdon waived his statute of limitations. And the problem that I have with that is that he had asked in this case for an instruction on the SA3, the sex assault in the third degree, which would have been a C felony, less than what he'd been charged with, which was the sex assault in the first degree.
So why wouldn't Timoteo apply there, where the request for a lesser included constituted a waiver of the statute of limitation claims with respect to the lesser included?
With respect to the lesser included, that my initial argument was yes, he did so waive it because he was seeking this benefit, a quid pro quo, so to speak, that, uh-huh. You know, I wasn't charged with the SA-2-3, but in order for the jury to be instructed on that possibility, I'd be willing to waive my statute of limitations.
Mm-hmm.
I do see that it conflicts with the requirement that, you know, that the jury, you know, that the state prove under 114 all of the subsections A through E. But returning to what you were saying about Timoteo, the problem that I have with that is that the ICA then said that, okay, because you requested the included offense instruction, that means you've waived the statute of limitations on the greater instruction, on the greater offense.
On the charged offense.
On the
right.
Charged offense.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly Mr. Abdon and his counsel were not aware that by making that request that he was somehow automatically giving up the right to have the statute of limitations shown as to the SA1 offense.
Do you understand the logic of that principle then? Was put forth?
No. I mean, I can see it as for the SA3, but I don't see it as for the sex assault one. Because they're apples and oranges, right? I don't see it.
And the whole one of the whole purposes of the lesser argument, if I remember, I think Justice Nakayama wrote the opinion, and she one of the arguments that was discussed was that if you allowed it, if the defense could allow the lesser to go and not be a waiver, you're sort of misrepresenting to the jury that they could actually find guilt on a lesser when in fact they couldn't. That was one of the, because
you're talking about Timoteo.
Exactly.
Yeah.
How does that logic have anything to do with saying it's taken away on the greater?
It doesn't.
I think the waiver issue also was raised with respect to the failure to raise the statute of limitations claim prior to the time of the jury verdict. Would you like to respond to that issue?
Raised. Well, I believe that they cited 12, HRPP 12, particularly 12B, and I don't see that applies, frankly, because, first of all, it says under B, pretrial motions, any defense or objection. And although there are references to the statute of limitations or timeliness being a defense, I submit that that's sort of a loose descriptor, that it's really not a defense, but it is a fact that needs to be shown. And it also says, continuing on reading 12B, is that it may be raised before the trial by motion. Under 12B1 and 2, they're talking about defects in the institution of the prosecution and defects in the charge. And
doesn't the rule also say which is capable of determination without the trial? And under the section, even though I may disagree with you as to what facts may have to be proven,
right.
To prove the offense, you have to prove the date and the location and all those things. And I'm not sure how this rule could possibly have any applicability.
It
talking
doesn't
about
come
a trial.
Until trial. The other concern I had, Your Honor, Justice Wilson, would be that if the defense attorney did bring that to the, you know, to the court's attention, you know, before or during trial, basically, he's possibly committing ineffective assistance of counsel by alerting the state to something that he sees as a defect that hasn't been proven, and then that would, of course, they make sure to plug that hole.
Anything further at this point?
You folks have covered everything that I had to say. I will reserve the rest of my time.
For rebuttal, then.
Yes.
Very well. Mr. Tsushima, your argument.
May it please the Court, Deputy Prosecuting Attorney Stephen Tsushima on behalf of the State of Hawaii. Good morning, Chief Justice.
Good morning.
And Associate Justices.
Good morning.
The best way I can illustrate the state's point today is that there's a difference between proof before a jury and the facts as before the trial court in determining such matters as a motion to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction, venue, or statute of limitations. And I think the way this issue had originally arisen in the trial court below was, I believe, a confusion between the two that the trial court had, because as I understand it, the trial court was the one that raised this issue in the first place. And when I say proof before a jury, as is stated multiple times in cases, it's the who did what to whom, where, and when of the case relating to the offense. And those are the facts that 701.114.1e contemplates when it states that the fact that the state must prove beyond a reasonable doubt, quote, facts establishing the offense was committed within the time period specified in section 701.108. And the state concedes the types of facts that that's referring to are the types of facts that's also required, that the state is required to put in the indictment when it comes to such facts as tolling facts for statutory purposes. And that's what was put in the indictment in this case, on the indictment that was filed on April 24, 2012, such as that the complaining witness was born on April 26, 1988, became 18 years of age on April 26, 2006, and is still alive, pursuant to 701.108.6c of the Hawaii Revised Statutes. So that's what 701.114.1e contemplates with regard to facts that the state must establish beyond a reasonable doubt and must put before the jury. The state will concede that. Now, what I'm going to refer to as boundaries is what the court is considering on a motion to dismiss for lack of jurisdiction, failure of venue, or violation of statute of limitations. And those are the things the trial court can take judicial notice of under HRE Rule 201, B, C, D, and F.
What specifically are you suggesting the court to take judicial notice of?
The indictment in this case.
So what does that mean? The prosecution would read the indictment, or the court would read the indictment, and then the court would take judicial notice of. Could you be a little more specific?
No, not at all, Your Honor. To be more specific, that wouldn't even come before the jury at all. This is on a motion to dismiss for violation of statute of limitations at a hearing, not in front of the jury, but before the trial court. That's where the court could properly take judicial notice of the records and files of the case, which would include the indictment.
Judicial notice for the purpose of establishing what facts?
The filing date of the indictment, which would be an undisputable fact, which the court could take judicial notice of under Roxas v.
And
Marcos.
Then how would that fact be utilized before the jury?
It would not be utilized before the jury. That's not what 701.114 contemplates. That would be a fact. The best way I could explain it is it's the same way that court would make the determination of venue, and what the case law has said, the court can make a take judicial notice of, and that's the statutes before HRS 806, 16, and 17 with regard to venue. HRS section 603.1, Hawaii Rules of Penal Procedure Rule 18, and matters such as like the Atlas of Hawaii to determine whether a case actually falls within the venue of the court. Those types of things would not be brought before the jury. That's not what HRS section 701.114 contemplates is brought in front of the jury. It never has. The case law within this jurisdiction has never said that that's what.
What would happen if the dates on the indictment were illegible, or there was otherwise some dispute about when the grand jury had acted and or when the document had been filed? What should happen then?
We would submit that that would be brought before the trial court, and that would be a matter for the trial court to determine, because that's going to be true as a matter of law based on that determination.
Not judicial notice, there would be a hearing on that issue then?
There should be a hearing, outside the trial hearing before the court on a motion to dismiss, I assume, for violation of statute of limitations. And that would be probably heard before the trial court, not before the jury. I don't believe 704.114.
That would not be proof beyond a reasonable doubt?
That would not be the facts establishing the offense was committed within the statute of limitations.
What if
that would be
I'm sorry. What if the...
Can I just finish
that, because that's what refers to the boundaries that the trial court would determine. And that's what I would say is proper in a motion to dismiss outside of the trial, not what is shown before the trial, because what's shown before the trial are the facts relating to the offense itself and tolling facts under 701, 114, 1E.
What if it was like a six-year statute of limitations and the offense was, there was a dispute as to whether or not it occurred at 11:59 p.m. or 12:01 a.m. and the indictment was filed 6 years plus one day after the 11:59 p.m. and the indictment says on or about, let's say it was, the question is whether it was December 31st at 11:59 or January 1st at 12:01, and the indictment says on or about January 1st. Let's say it was January 1st, 2010, according to the state, and then the indictment is filed on January 1st, 2016. But the defense is that, wait a minute, it happened at 11:59 on December 31st, 2009. The court determines whether or not the statute of limitations has been satisfied?
Yeah, I'm not as good following dates and years as you are.
Well, just assuming that, that's the cutoff.
No,
just assuming that that's just...
I believe I understand your question, though.
Because this one was actually just 2 days, right?
That's right.
Made it by 2 days, right?
That's right.
I mean, what if it was like 2 days later and the question was it 11:59 p.m. or 12:01 a.m.?
And that still wouldn't change what I believe are the two different things that must be, that the state must prove beyond a reasonable doubt under 701-114 would be the offense date. That would be what the jury would, evidence would have to be shown before the jury, and that would have to be found beyond a reasonable doubt. But as to the filing date, on that matter, that would be before the trial court. That is a matter that, on a motion to dismiss for violation of statute of limitations, would be argued before the trial court. So the second part of your fact pattern, we would submit, would not be properly argued before the jury.
So the state wouldn't have to prove, the state would not have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt when the document was filed?
Correct.
Isn't that a question of fact?
It's not a question of fact that's contemplated under 701-114. That's going to be true as a matter of law on a motion to dismiss. And that's not something that, because what the 701-114 is specifically stating is that the state needs to bring only the facts relating to the offense committed and the tolling facts. That's going to establish, based on that, that's going to establish the date of what I'm going to refer to as the boundaries. It does not say, and the judiciary could have put, as well as the facts that show when the indictment was found or complaint filed, but the judiciary did not put that in 701-114. That's why we're submitting that is the matter that's to be determined before the court.
In those situations, the court would submit an interrogatory to the jury and say, if there was confusion about the date, the exact time of the offense, and would ask the jury, did you find beyond a reasonable doubt, and put the specific date that would be required to bring it within the statute of limitations. So if the answer was no, they didn't prove it beyond a reasonable doubt, then you would not have proven the fact to make the prosecution timely.
I believe that would be correct under that scenario. The bigger obstacle this morning we submit would be the waiver issue. That defendant did not raise this issue before or at trial, and that would be pursuant to U.S. v. Guitar, as cited within State v. Timoteo.
Could you help us with that, Mr. Tsushima? What's the logic that says that because a lesser included was requested in this case, that the statute of limitations issue is waived with respect to the charge defense?
I think it's waived in two ways. The first is by asking for the lesser included. The second is by not raising it at all before or at trial.
The lesser included is the subject of the statute of limitations issue. There's an argument that it would be disingenuous, inconsistent with the idea that the court is actually being asked to give a lesser included offense, and therefore if you're asking the court to commit what could be, you know, a violation of statute of limitations, that would be an inconsistent and inappropriate position to be taken by the defense. But how does that apply to the idea that defense is going to wait and see whether or not the government proves the elements necessary to overcome the statute of limitations and then at a later time make an objection to the charge defense?
I think the problem is twofold. First is that it would be logically consistent that defendant is waiving the statute of limitations as to the lesser included, but not as to the greater.
Why is that logically inconsistent? In the first example with the lesser, the defendant has asked for the lesser, but I'm not sure the defendant has asked to be charged on the greater offense. That's usually a prosecution decision.
Because if the defense is waiving the statute of limitations as to the lesser, then it's logically consistent that the prosecution was brought within the statute of limitations of the greater. I don't know if I'm expressing myself properly, because the statute of limitations would have been shorter as to the lesser. If they're waiving it as to that, then the statute of limitations as to that, then as to the greater window of statute of limitations, it would logically follow that they're waiving statute of limitations. Excuse me?
There are different statutes of limitations.
Right, and it's a larger statute of limitations for the greater offense. So if they're waiving it and saying it was within the statute of limitations for the shorter offense, for which otherwise it would have run, and saying,
I understand what you're saying.
That it would have run.
No, I understand your logic, okay. But the equities of requesting an instruction for which you are going to later argue that time is run, I don't see how the equities transfers to the a greater offense, the charged offense.
What? Putting the equities aside for a second, I think what it effectively is showing is that you are waiving the statute of limitations issue. And in any event, what Timoteo has stated and cited to was U.S. v. Tatar, which says that the statute of limitations is not jurisdictional, it's an defense, which is waived in this circuit if it's not asserted before or at trial.
Okay, but taking your logic, what if the defense does raise a statute of limitations defense as to the greater charge? You're saying, but decides, you know, still requests the lesser included. You're saying by requesting the lesser included, even though they haven't waived, even though they asserted a statute of limitations defense as to the greater, by requesting the lesser, they're waiving the statute of limitations as to the greater?
Yes.
So you're promoting.
So you're, in other words, you're saying that the defense attorney basically is, you're almost asking the defense attorney to commit ineffective assistance. They can't request the lesser, because if they do, they're going to waive the greater?
Well, with regard to the statute of limitations? Yes.
Right. Let's say that you raise it as to the sex assault one, the A felony, and say, I have a statute of limitations defense. We are asserting a statute of limitations defense, and we want a special interrogatory on that issue. But we also want you to instruct on the lesser. And by requesting that the lesser included instruction be given, you're saying the defense has now waived the statute of limitations defense on the greater offense.
I guess perhaps maybe I'm not expressing myself properly, because now it's made clear to me. If it is brought before the court that there is a challenge as to the statute of limitations, as to the greater, no, I'm not saying that they're waiving it. What I'm saying is where it is not raised at the trial level and they're requesting the lesser included in that situation, it is waived. And the reason I refer to U.S. v. Guitar is because it says it has to be raised before or at trial. So where you're preserving it at trial, I would agree you can preserve it. But that's not what happened in this case.
So basically you're suggesting that the waiver is because it was just never raised.
Correct.
Not because he requested the lesser included.
Correct.
So is it really appropriate to cite to Timoteo for that basis?
No, not for that basis.
Okay.
I agree. I believe that.
Sorry, so you're abandoning the argument under Timoteo? Is that what you're doing?
No, Your Honor.
Okay.
I'm specifically emphasizing that under Timoteo and under the Ninth Circuit Court cases cited within Timoteo, that if the statute of limitations defense was not brought before or at trial, it is waived. And to the extent that Timoteo doesn't say that or agree with that, I would submit that it would be proper for this court to make that finding. It'd be consistent with the Ninth Circuit cases within it that cited within Timoteo and also within Guitar. And that's U.S. v. Minor, 756 F. 2nd, 731, Ninth Circuit 1985 case, which has the statute of limitations is an affirmative defense waived unless raised at trial. Bittinger v. Commissioner of Police, 245 U.S., 128, 1917 case, which is still good law, it says the statute of limitations is a defense. It must be asserted on the trial by the defendant in criminal cases.
When you say at trial, could it be after the prosecution has put in all its evidence?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, as long as it's before a verdict. And also under one more case, Pruitt v. U.S., 3 F. 2nd, 353, 1925 case that says the question is not properly before the court unless it was raised properly before the trial court, the appellate court for review if it was not raised first at the trial court.
I'm not really familiar with the federal criminal statutes, and I guess we'll have to go take a look at it. But is it structured the way 701.114 is? It says the state must prove, the government must prove beyond a reasonable doubt the elements of the offense, the facts establishing venue, facts establishing jurisdiction, the state of mind, and facts establishing that the offense the charge has been commenced within the applicable time period.
I apologize. I'm not familiar with the
because we don't know. We need to really go back and look at those the federal statutes to see if it's actually characterized as something that the government has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt or whether it's characterized as an affirmative defense, correct?
Sure. So so if defendant can overcome the hurdle of waiver in this issue, there is also the matter of harmless error under HRPP Rule 52A, that any error, defect, irregularity, or variance which does not affect substantial rights shall be disregarded. And in this case, I lost my train of thought. Consistent with Guitar and Yuli, where uncontradicted and undisputed evidence of timely prosecution is contained in the record, the trial court's failure to instruct the jury is harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And that's what we have in this case. And defendant has conceded such that there is uncontradicted and undisputed evidence in the record of that the offense occurred on June 1997, that the minor's date of birth was April 26, 1988, that minor became 18 years of age, April 26, 2006, and was still alive. Based on those matters and on HRPP Rule 52A of harmless error, petitioner cannot meet its burden of showing that the ICA committed a reversible error in this case.
So you would concede the jury should have been instructed on those matters, but your argument is the failure to do so was harmless, correct?
Do you disagree with Chief Judge Nakamura that the objection to the statute of limitations must be pretrial? You're
yes,
saying it just has to be before it goes to the jury.
Yes, I do disagree. And specifically, based on the facts that I just stated, those the facts would have to come out before trial, and based on the way the testimony or evidence
right.
could come out, I do understand that a statute of limitations issue could come out,
right.
and therefore that Rule 12 would not apply.
Okay.
If the court has any more questions, otherwise I've covered the main points I wanted to make today.
Very well. Thank you very much.
Thanks,
Mr. Tsushima. Ms. Hiranaka, your rebuttal.
the state's reliance on DITAR. DITAR was mentioned a number of times. DITAR does say that the defendant is entitled to a jury instruction on a time-barred lesser if he waives the statute of limitations for that included offense, regardless if it's express or whatever. But it's for that included offense. It doesn't stand for the proposition that I think the state is asserting, which is that it means that he waives it on the charged offense, the greater offense.
Why would we address, if it isn't raised below, why would it be addressed any differently than the way we address any error that hasn't been raised? Wouldn't we apply the same standards?
Yes. Yes, we would. With regard to the state's statement that as long as it's before verdict, basically Rule 29 permits a defendant to file under C a post-verdict motion for judgment of acquittal, which is what the defense did in this case, albeit at the suggestion of the trial judge. So I don't see that there is a reason that it has to be that he cannot raise a defense to the statute of limitations post-verdict.
Suppose a certain date of offense is alleged in the indictment, and when the witnesses take the stand, a different date, they relate a different date of offense. Wouldn't that be up to the, should it be given to the trier of fact to determine what the actual date of offense was? Suppose their witnesses are, one says the 4th, one says the 6th, one would be within the statute, one wouldn't. How can that be fair to wait till after it goes to the verdict, to the jury, to then come in and set aside the verdict? Well, in that case, there'd be substantial evidence to support it, but
right.
Shouldn't that be brought to the attention so that of the trial court so that an interrogatory can be sent to the trier of fact?
Under the circumstances that you're speaking of, which is that there's,
a dispute.
Dispute in evidence. It does seem correct that the trier of fact should be the one to determine that.
It shouldn't be allowable to be able to wait till after it goes to verdict, right? Shouldn't it be sent, the question should be presented to the court before it goes to the jury?
I guess I'm also thinking of, though, if, the trial attorney looks at all the evidence after the close of the evidence, regardless of what the verdict is, and says, you know what, I do see a problem now. I don't think that the defense should be foreclosed from making a request of the trial court, which is what he did do in this case.
So just so I understand, Ms. Hironaka, at what point in the, how should the defendant go about raising a challenge to the timeliness? It could be post-trial, or how do you think, how should the challenge be raised?
Ideally, I would say that it could be raised in your during trial MJOA. I guess my concern is that the whether the defense would be subject to ineffective assistance for then alerting the prosecution to the lack of proof in its case, and that there would be prosecution motions to, take judicial notice or, somehow fix the failure to prove that particular piece of evidence.
But isn't that sort of the nature of the motion for judgment of acquittal, where the defense is raising for the court's consideration the failure of the government to produce evidence as to a certain element, and why would it be any different if it has to do with statute of limitations?
You're correct. You're correct. I think the last thing that I wanted to address had to do with plain error, which is that Judge Kim, who was the trial judge in this case, noted, and it was quoted in his finding, his oral findings, that he felt that there was plain error in his failure to instruct the jury about the date of birth and the fact that the complainant was alive. He did not agree that he had to instruct him on the date of the charging instrument, but he also said that the failure of proof on, having the jury find those things did affect the substantial rights of the defendant. And so that was another suggestion that he had, that there was a problem.
Well, when you say those things, that Judge Kim conceded that he'd made a mistake in not instructing on those things, how do you interpret that specifically? What would those things be?
Well, Judge Kim said, with respect to the, it was just the date of birth and the fact that she was alive. He did not agree that the date of the indictment was something that the jury needed to be instructed on. But he did say that there was no jury instruction to the jury. No instruction
yes.
to the jury.
And I'm sorry to belabor that, but it does seem that the record reflects that Judge Kim was pretty clear about those being the two areas in which he failed to give instruction. But I am still reaching for the idea that the evidence didn't nonetheless show both of those things unequivocally.
Correct. Because the jury wasn't asked, say, by interrogatories or otherwise, to make that specific finding. There was evidence presented because of
no, I'm suggesting that unequivocal evidence was offered as to both of those points, whether the complaining witness was alive and what her age was, and therefore there isn't a contest at all about those two facts, and therefore it's harmless error. I just wanted to give you a last chance to suggest that there is any contest as to those two areas that Judge Kim singled out.
I mean, I'm sorry to have to belabor my point, which is that I have to go back to the 114.
Right, it's a legal analysis, essentially. You're not saying there's a factual issue. You're just saying just as a matter of law,
correct,
those are areas in which there has to be a jury instruction.
That's correct.
Ms. Hernock, would you like to wrap up in any way?
The one thing that I want to inform the court of is, though, that originally when I was seeking cert on this particular issue, that I was not disputing the ICA's decision with regard to the new trial necessitated on the failure to give the lesser SA3 instruction. But I do recognize that if the court goes with what Mr. Abdon is arguing in this particular case, that would basically require a complete reversal of his conviction, and that there would not be a new trial ordered on the SA3 because it would be a failure of the evidence.
Very well. Thank you. Thank you to both of our attorneys here today, and the court will take this matter under advisement.